Thursdays, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, in Studio B at Revolution.radio.
Moscow's freeze. That's your cerebral cortex looking for an answer it doesn't have.
See? Even your brain knows you're screwed.
Your brain is filling with adrenaline right now. Whether you know it or not. The heart's beating fast. It's getting a little harder to breathe. Your neurobiological system is telling it to run. But your knees are too weak to move.
Fear is not real. The only place that fear can exist is in our thoughts of the future. It is a product of our imagination, causing us to fear things that do not at present and may not ever exist. That is near insanity. Do not misunderstand me. Danger is very real, but fear is a choice. We are all telling ourselves a story.
You're listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. 100% listener-supported radio. Reporting the danger. Unafraid. Right here, where information never sleeps. Revolution. Revolution. Radio!
They can be a bit of inspiration in my my radio career.
You must be some kind of a kook.
Thank you.
It's hard out of here for a pimp.
All right, listen up, y'all.
A bunch of a-holes.
Where are you going to go? Where are you going to run? Where are you going to hide?
Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention?
Your systems are all closed.
Mario! Do it live! Do it live! I'll write it and we'll do it live!
What the hell's going on out here?
Ladies and gentlemen, here it is.
Here it is.
Here it is.
Here it is.
Like
you. Hashtag confused, dude.
What kind of feeling? I'm high on believing. That you're in love with me.
I'm not good enough.
503 Central, 403 Mountain, 303 West Coast, 603 East Coast. Good evening, Iceland. Happy Tuesday, Australia. Hang on a second. Breaking news. Bigfoot is alive and kicking for Omega Logos in the chat. At revolution.radio, common spelling in your favorite internet browser. Just simply click on chat room. You can join the conversation. I have seen Yowie's Humpies at the local Arboretum. Yeah, I know. Yeah, we got a Yowie update, sort of, kind of, in a way. But not really. Kind of. Dean Harrison's Australian Yowie Research. Is it Yowie? Like Howie? There you go. Link in the chat room for Dean Harrison's Australian Yowie Research. Compliments of yowiehunters.com.au for Australia. Stand by.
Yeah, exactly. You know, there were times when I was doing Jack that I actually felt retarded, like really retarded. Oh,
yeah. I mean, I brushed my teeth retarded. I rode bus retarded.
Damn. In a weird way, I had to sort of just free myself up to believe that it was okay to be stupid or dumb.
To be a moron.
Yeah.
To be moronical.
Exactly. To be a moron.
An imbecile.
Yeah.
Like the dumbest motherfucker that ever lived.
When I was playing the character.
When you was a character.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, as Jack.
Definitely. Yeah. Jack. Stupid ass Jack. Trying to come back from that.
In a weird way, it was almost like I had to sort of fool my mind into believing that it wasn't retarded. And by the end of the whole thing, I was like, wait a minute, you know? I flushed so much out, how am I going to jumpstart it up again. It's just like,
yeah.
Yeah, right?
You was farting in bathtubs and laughing your ass off.
Yeah.
But Simple Jack thought he was smart. Or rather, didn't think he was retarded, so he can't afford to play retarded being a smart actor. Playing a guy who ain't smart but thinks he is, that's tricky.
Tricky.
It's like working with mercury. It's high science, man. It's art form.
Yeah.
You an artist.
That's what we do, right?
Yeah. Hats off for going there. Especially knowing how the Academy is about that shit.
Wait. About what?
You serious? You don't know. Everybody knows you never go full retard.
What do you mean?
Check it out. Dustin Hoffman, Rayman, look retarded, act retarded. Not retarded. Count two picks, cheat of cards. Autistic. Sure. Not retarded. You got Tom Hanks, Forrest Gump. Slow, yes, retarded, maybe. Braces on his legs. But he charmed the pants off next to him and won a ping pong competition. That ain't retarded. He was a goddamn war hero. Right. You know any retarded war heroes? You went full retard, man. Never go full retard. You don't buy that? That's Sean Penn, 2001, I am Sam. Remember? Went full retard. Went home empty-handed.
The question is, why did I play that clip? It's from a movie called Tropic Thunder that is so politically incorrect, it could not be made today, and it would probably end up being banned and having the actors Ben Stiller, Robert Downey Jr., Jack Black, I forget the two other characters, Nick Nolte was in there, completely banned from Hollywood. I'm just saying. Look, if you can find the movie Tropic Thunder, I want you to watch it because it is by far the funniest movie, and it is a comedic look at the ridiculousness, I guess, of Hollywood. It's actually pretty funny. There's a link to the IMD page if you wish to opine. I was listening to what was being played on. Hang on a second. Three kids. I hear rain and I have to pee. But what is the memes talking? It was a joke. Calm down. It was a joke. It was a joke, memes. Oh, gosh. So apparently this lady, a name I can't pronounce, had 69 total kids, which included some triplets, quadruplets, twins, et cetera, et cetera. And apparently this happened in the 18th century. My reply was, did her uterus fall out? And memes in the chat room replies, please, what was her urinary functioning like? I don't know. I don't know what it was like. I mean, you got to do those Kegel exercises, the Kegel exercises. I think you have to do Kegel exercises after you have kids. She probably just pissed all over the place. But that was pretty funny, memes. That was pretty funny. So I hear these Relief Factor commercials. Look, and I know on Revolution Radio we don't sell advertising, so I guess I can say this. And I've heard these examples, and I've always thought to myself, if you have back pain and you take ibuprofen, where does the ibuprofen or aspirin or what have you, how does it know where to go? I mean, it doesn't. That's the joke. But apparently Relief Factor, I mean, has some common ingredients in it that you can simply just buy for a cheaper cost instead of buying the Relief Factor. I mean, I don't know if this is reputable. I don't know if these folks at consumerlab.com have any credibility, but this seems to be like a decent site to check out if you are interested in looking up whatever you hear about on the radio and whether or not it is good or it's not good. And I don't know if these folks are somehow paid by whomever to type whatever, but excuse me, it really doesn't matter. Dateline Breitbart News. Soccer star Alicia Lehman claims a very well-known celebrity offered her big cash to sleep with him. Well, the photo is slightly provocative. It looks like her headlights are on, and I kind of like the tattoo on her wrist and her right forearm. Let's continue. British soccer star Alicia Lehman
often called the, quote, sexiest soccer star in the world, end quote, claims that she was offered more than $100,000 to spend the night with a very well-known celebrity. Well, that's only 10% of the $1 million that Robert Redford offered Demi Moore in the film Indecent Proposal. The 24-year-old Straka, a native of Switzerland, told her story on the Dire Tea Talk podcast with host Sharon David and said the offer appeared suddenly on her cell phone when she was in Miami, Florida, Fox News reported. Is there a picture of the text message with a blacked out number? No, but there is this picture via the X. Look, she's a good looking lady. You know, whatever. Oh, 110 grand for a one nighter. Read a link through the New York Post. Let's continue. She added that she dismissed the text at first because she had no way of knowing if it was real, but then said that a security guard also contacted by the mystery celebrity to, so now she knows it's real. Oh, what's going on here? I mean, you could just have agents call agents, et cetera, et cetera. I'm just saying. The message said, I will pay Alicia $100,000 Swiss francs to spend the night with her, but my answer was no way, and just 100 grand, she scoffed. So the question now isn't whether or not you'd give up your body for sex. The question is whether or not how much somebody would have to pay you. That's the issue now. That's the issue. You won't take 100 grand, but it was more than 100 grand. Would you reconsider? Lehman said she is keeping the text on her phone out of amusement, but has thus far refused to reveal who the celebrity might be. The blonde Premier League bombshell plays for Aston Villa out of Birmingham, UK, earned 5 goals in 22 matches last season, but has yet scored during the first 2 games of this season. Blah, 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 blah. There you go. Well, I mean, look. Obviously, she won't do it for 100 grand, so the question is how much? I mean, you know, it's comical, as they say. It's comical. Sticking with soccer, Cristiano Ronaldo, if you don't know who he is, he's a famous soccer player, faces 99 lashes after innocently showing affection and appreciation to a handicapped Iranian artist. If he ever chooses to revisit the Islamic Republic of Iran again. Ooh. Ronaldo was in Iran last month to play Al Nassr's Asian Championship League game against Persepolis on September 19th. However, before the game, fans greeted Ronaldo, and some of those fans had gifts for him. One such fan was Fatima Hamimi, an Iranian artist who paints with her feet because she is handicapped. Hamimi presented Ronaldo with 2 portraits she had painted of him. As a sign of appreciation, Ronaldo posted for a photo with Hamimi and gave her a hug and a kiss on the forehead. Apparently, it's not innocent enough. According to Iranian law, because Ronaldo is in a relationship with another woman, his girlfriend Georgina Rodriguez, it's actually considered adultery for him to engage in signs of affection with another woman. The penalty for such an offense could be 99 slashes. But there's hope, kids. Ronaldo can be exempted from the punishment if he shows remorse for his actions. It's not clear what that remorse would entail, but Ronaldo may not have to worry about it, considering he isn't scheduled to return to Iran unless the team advances to the Asian Championship League tournament. Well, there you go. You simply just... give a hug to an appreciative fan who just happens to be handicapped and paints with her feet, and you, my friend. Oh, this is it. Here, let me post for you the adulterous act by Ronaldo. The adulterous act. Look at it. First of all, this woman's got some artistic ability. The adulterous act. Hugging her not once but twice. A kiss on the forehead. That's going to get you 99 slashes. Man alive. Wow. Well, we're staying with soccer. See what I'm doing here? 2 soccer stories, right?
I should refer to it as football. Now I'm going to refer to football, the American sport. Former NFL wide receiver Antonio Brown arrested for allegedly not paying child support. Here's my gripe about these sons of bitches. NFL, if you don't know, this is normally how it works. You're a top 10 pick. You're guaranteed a certain amount of money. Your manager gets something. Your agent gets something. Your publicist gets something. Taxes get something, whatever. You got some coin. If you are injured in the first week and out for the entire season, you still get that guaranteed money. And some folks don't know that if you make the playoffs, depending on how well you play in the playoffs, if you're league MVP, if you're MVP, you make it the Super Bowl, if you make it to the Pro Bowl, etc., you get some more cheddar cheese. Anyway, this Tampa Bay Buccaneer wide receiver award winner allegedly has refused to pay child support to the mother of his child. Quote, "I did not want him arrested," said Wiltress Jackson, mother of Brown's daughter, Antayaya, "because right now he's making a mockery out of the judge, out of everything, because he feels like he's untouchable." Well, he's one of those athletes. Jackson claims Brown owes her nearly $31,000 in back child support. A Florida judge ordered Brown arrested in August due to unpaid support. Dude, pay your child support, you lazy SOB. I mean, seriously, pay your child support. How tough is that to do? I don't know what you make for a salary, but that's just, that's probably just walking around change. And if you're interested about watching the Olympics, if you're a cricket fan, a flag football fan, a lacrosse fan, a squash fan, is that five? Cricket, flag football, lacrosse, squash. I think there's a fifth sport making the 2028 Olympics. Can't cricket take days? It's huge in India, from what I understand. It's huge. But there's gonna be flag football, cricket, lacrosse, squash, and there's a fifth sport, I think, and I don't remember what it is, and for some reason it is not listed here. That's fine. Well, there you go. There you go, kids. And then finally, a sumo wrestler group deemed too heavy to fly, airline books extra flight. A Japanese airline had to book an extra flight for a large group of extra-large sumo wrestlers after they determined that the wrestlers exceeded the weight limit for the two aircraft. That's fat. According to Japan News, the wrestlers were flying from Tokyo to Osaka to attend a special national sports festival at the Amami Oshima Island. However, as the airline began booking the athletes, they realized that each wrestler weighed 264 pounds on average, 100 pounds more than the average weight of the average passenger. This prompted officials to believe that extra planes were necessary. A total of 14 wrestlers flew aboard the extra plane. In all, 460 wrestlers made up the trip to Amami Oshima Island for the sports festival. It's unclear how much the flights it took to get them there, but at 260 pounds per wrestler and 14 wrestlers per plane, that comes to a lot of rice being eaten. How do these people fit in the bathrooms? I mean, I don't know. I don't know if these folks, I don't even know what the average lifespan of a sumo wrestler is, but that's big. That's big, kids. B as in B, big. That's fat, and I'm not talking P-H-A-T. See it there? P-H-A-T. Whatever. All right, folks. Bedtime stories. For your listening enjoyment.
In this story, the first of two in this episode, we'll be delving into Australia's most notorious alien encounter. One that would become a pivotal catalyst in propelling knowledge of life beyond Earth into the public mainstream.
Right, folks.
Join us as we take a late-night cruise with the Cahill family into the cold, lonely depths of missing time through the foothills of the southern Dandenong Mountains. It was like waking from some vague daydream. As she returned to her senses, focusing on the dark silhouettes of the trees as they rushed past outside the window, Kelly Cahill turned to her husband with an odd look of confusion upon her face. Andrew seemed focused upon the road ahead, before he finally turned to her with an equally haunted expression. Meekly, she asked him if she had fallen asleep, but he couldn't answer. He simply affected a tighter grip on the steering wheel and shook his head with uncertainty. It was obvious to both of them that they were experiencing the same sense of inner turmoil, though they could not understand what that turmoil was or why they felt it. Something had just happened, but for some reason, they had no recollection of it. There was an odd odour inside the vehicle, and she could feel a small irritation, like a minor burning sensation somewhere on her midriff. But it was this vague memory of the red lights that bothered her. She didn't know what the lights were or where she had seen them, just that there had been many, all gliding towards her. The car hit a pothole in the road, snatching her from her reverie. Stunned and disorientated, the couple continued their journey in silence, exhausted and longing for their beds, wanting only to alleviate whatever mysterious deeds had unsettled them. On the 8th of August 1993, Kelly and Andrew Cahill were driving home after attending a barbecue hosted by one of their friends. Although it was winter in Australia, it had not been particularly cold. The evening had brought with it a cool breeze and some pockets of light rain, but it had not been enough to dampen their spirits. They had sat chatting with their friends for many hours before finally heading home at around midnight. Their journey took them along Belgrave Hallam Road. Stretching over the long Dandenong Mountains of southern Australia, the pair made their way through the rolling countryside with ease, looking forward to retiring to their beds due to the lateness of the hour. However, at some point along their route, they spotted what Kelly described as a blimp rising out of the distance. Slowing down, they kept their eyes on this strange object as it drew closer and realized it was actually disc-shaped. Hovering at double the height of the treetops, it drew fast upon them, emitting a dazzling orange glow. The couple could not take their eyes off it as they peered at dark figures standing tall behind what appeared to be windows around the object's outer rim. Kelly had just enough time to point and tell Andrew to look at the people in the windows before it suddenly disappeared. Under the waning moon, the couple continued for another mile or so before noticing a blinding light in the middle distance. The closer they moved towards it, the more they realized it appeared to be a screen of pure white light draped across the landscape ahead of them. Kelly raised her hand to shield her eyes as they drove into it, unable to see anything beyond its radiance. The next thing she knew, the light had disappeared, but their car seemed to be much further along the road, and Kelly immediately wondered if she had blacked out. When the couple returned home, Kelly noticed a mysterious geometric marking below her navel, a red equilateral triangle, the sides of which were about 10 millimeters in length. Several layers of skin within this marking appeared to have been burned away, The couple also discovered that they returned home an hour and a half later than they should have done, meaning that there were 90 minutes of their journey they could not account for. Exhausted, they didn't think too much of it, but the next morning, Kelly in particular began to feel that something was off. Over the next few days, she commenced a long and heavy menstruation, even though her next cycle was not due for a while. This was accompanied by daily nauseating migraines, which she experienced on and off for about 6 weeks. Medical treatment was sought, and doctors were able to detect an infection in her womb. Further tests were carried out, including sonograms, but nothing would yield an answer as to its cause. She was then hospitalized, and only after being placed on a strong course of antibiotics did her symptoms begin to abate. As for her migraines, the doctors performed CAT scans looking for any signs of trauma, but again, nothing was detected. She was simply given painkillers and discharged. But in reality, the real horror of what took place was only just beginning. Soon, a whole sequence of harrowing events would begin to unfold from her memory, events so extraordinary that her accounts would leave UFO investigators and medical professionals arrested by their utter perplexity and marvel. What she would discover would forever leave an impression, not just upon her life, but also upon her skin and in the soil and grass where those memories were forged. On the night in question, after driving through the mysterious curtain of light, Kelly eventually recalled that they pulled off the road and parked next to a large open field. But what awaited them in that field, they could never have imagined. A colossal craft the size of a three-story building and as wide as an Olympic swimming pool hovered in the air a short distance away. The two of them stepped out of their vehicle, and it quickly became apparent that Kelly and Andrew were not the only ones who had stopped to observe the strange object. Two other cars had pulled up about 100 or so meters away. A man and two women in the closest of these vehicles, and another man traveling alone in the one furthest away. Exhilarated by this rare opportunity to witness something so extraordinary, Kelly and the others looked on in amazement. But then, a tall dark figure appeared beneath the craft, with a large group of other dark figures standing behind it. Slowly, Kelly's enthusiasm soured into a brooding uncertainty which pooled in the pit of her stomach. She stated that this sensation was like low-frequency waves, so dense and profound that it became an arresting physical weight upon her. Spellbound, she lost control of her senses and suddenly went mad with absolute terror. She desperately tried to free herself from what she described as an almost hypnotic trance, but no matter how much she fought to secure her own sanity, there was nothing she could do. The figures, who possessed bright red eyes which were disproportionately large in relation to their heads, then split up and headed towards each separate gathering of people, affecting the appearance of demons gliding across the field towards them. One group charged after Cahill and her husband. Another sped after the party further down the road. An electric blow then struck Kelly at her solar plexus, knocking the wind out of her lungs and sending her flying onto her back. Struggling for breath, she attempted again and again to sit up, convinced she was about to die. Suddenly, Kelly was unable to see. There was nothing but darkness as she was overcome by an intense nausea. She sat up, screaming for Andrew, and a hand was then placed upon her shoulder. She recalls one of the figures speaking in plain English.
Do something about it.
Nearby, she could hear Andrew demanding to be released.
Let us go, you bastards.
We mean you no harm.
If you didn't mean us any harm, then why did you hit my wife?
Completely terrified, she vomited. She then felt someone examining her. The next moment, she and her husband were back in their car, driving on Belgrave Hallam Road, in silence. Kelly would later seek the assistance of UFO researchers, who would conduct the most thorough UFO investigation in Australia's history at that time. Cahill's case would be pivotal in bringing this subject into the public eye. For 18 months solid, the location of the incident was intensely probed. Researchers divided several acres of the field into 1 meter blocks with pegs and tape. Samples were taken from the ground. Aerial surveys were carried out using infrared photography, and magnetic readings were logged by a portable magnetometer. What was found would only prompt more questions regarding the significance of the markings discovered on some of the victims. The ground scans uncovered a large, 20-meter triangular shape in the field. Initially, it was thought to be an impression, but this turned out not to be the case. A carcinogen known as pyrene was instead discovered, which is a chemical found in coal mines, even though no coal mines were located anywhere near the field. Whatever the triangle signified, for 5 months following the event, Kelly would be visited 4 more times by one of the frightening beings she had witnessed, who would stand at her bedside in a cloak and hood. She described these visitations in a strange way. The experience would start as a dream, in which she wasn't able to see the entity, but could feel it in other ways. She felt as if she was being pulled by a nearby presence, which spoke to her and told her not to panic. But despite its assurances, she felt the same profound horror she had experienced on the field. It was only when she awoke that she would see the entity briefly standing over her before it disappeared right before her eyes. Aside from these odd visitations, she and Andrew would have countless bizarre electrical disturbances in their home. Kelly related how appliances and lights would turn on by themselves, and that she would receive static shocks through things which were not otherwise conductive, such as soil, wood, and rocks. The most incredible of these anomalies occurred when the engine of her car started of its own accord, despite the vehicle having still been locked and the kill switch activated. Psychologically, the whole incident had a tremendous effect on Cahill's husband. For many years he would not divulge his recollection of it, until reluctantly, he admitted to Kelly that not only did he remember his experience, but also that he'd had several UFO encounters prior to it. Unbeknown to the Cahills, the other people who had stopped to observe the strange object that night had also reported their experiences to researchers. Kelly Cahill had never met any of the occupants of the other vehicles, either before or after the event, and yet the similarity between each of the accounts is astonishing. On the night in question, the vehicle closest to them, parked about 100 meters away, was driven by a man named Bill. He was accompanied by his wife, Glenda, and a family friend named Jane. Another car was parked a further 30 meters beyond theirs, and this was occupied by a government law department employee named Dave. All of them, apart from Andrew, would produce illustrations of what they had seen. Neither group was made aware of each other's drawings until much later, and the uncanny resemblance between them would only further reinforce the reality and nature of the event. All depicted a circular craft lined with many windows and unnaturally dark figures standing between 6 and 7 feet tall, backlit by a bright white beam being emitted from above. Of the 6 witnesses, Kelly, Glenda, Jane and Dave each discovered a triangular burn mark on their body, located just below the navel. Andrew and Bill, however, had no such wound. The two other women had also suffered gynecological problems similar to Kelly's in the immediate aftermath, and Glenda in particular would recall waking up in a strange room, strapped to a table, and being examined by a tall entity dressed in a dark cloak. This sounds eerily similar to the creature described in Kelly's subsequent visitation experiences. The only difference in the accounts is that Bill, Glenda, Jane and Dave all reported hearing a humming sound from the craft and blacked out immediately after crossing the road to see what was in the field. Although they saw the figures, they don't recall them having bright red eyes as Kelly described. On the other hand, the Cahills didn't hear any humming and seemed to have remained conscious for a while longer than the other four witnesses. Kelly would go on to say that the eyes of the figures glowed red only after they began to glide towards them. Finally, the accounts of all six witnesses were backed up by reports from residents in the area, saying that they had seen a strange object in the skies at around the same time that the event occurred. There are many reports of alleged alien abduction the world over. And whilst those accounts are both harrowing and intriguing in their own ways, in nearly every single case, there is almost always only one witness. The fact that in this instance, there are multiple witnesses who were previously unfamiliar with each other, all reporting the same thing, lends a high degree of credence to their stories. And the fact that the studies of the ground on which the event took place yielded strange results, somewhat corroborating their accounts, should leave even the most ardent of skeptics wondering, what if? What was it that the Cahills and the others present experienced? Was it really an alien abduction, or could it have been a shared hallucination between all six witnesses? If so, what would have caused it? And why did residents across the region also report seeing a vivid orange light in the sky? Perhaps it was more spiritual in nature. Could they all have been spirited away, or even undergone a collective near-death experience? Kelly and Andrew certainly seemed to lean towards this possibility, at least at first. Having both come from deeply religious upbringings, their initial impressions of the beings who seized upon them were that they were entirely demonic in nature. For many people, the triangular abrasions discovered on their bodies go some way to supporting this assertion. As with the Buffalo Ranch in Colorado, where many otherworldly occurrences took place, some commentators believe that the painting of an equilateral triangle upon the carcasses of the mutilated cows was a way of mocking the Holy Trinity. It's also interesting that all six witnesses described the entities as featureless black shadows, much like the shadow people seen in many haunting experiences. Red-eyed shadow people, as they were described by Kelly herself, have been witnessed all over the world and are viewed by many cultures as demonic, carrying with them sinister agendas. Regardless of what the circumstances may be surrounding the events that took place in the Dandenong Mountains, it was certainly enough to have caused great distress in six different people all at once, to the point where it changed their lives forever. They would never be the same again. We only hope that Kelly, Andrew, Bill, Glenda, Jane and David managed to come to terms with what happened, and eventually found peace and solace in the face of such a terrifying experience. Story 2. The Demons on the Fringe. Regardless of where mankind's many civilizations and religions originated, there is a prevailing notion that death is not the end for us. The belief in some form of afterlife is almost universally accepted amongst the cultures of this world. In almost every religion, there are theoretical realms which mirror the Christian concepts of heaven and hell, with morality being the arbiter of our final destination, all dependent on how we elect to live our lives. And contained within those two opposing kingdoms, there are escorts and emissaries, waiting to usher the deceased onwards into the spirit world. Counterbalancing the depiction of angelic beings, there are writings and drawings of far more malevolent entities. Dark creatures dispatched by their masters to lay claim to the souls of those who have been selected to continue their existence in a place of purgatory and punishment. There exist countless reports regarding the actions of such entities, testimonies from those who claim to have survived attempts to remove them from the living world, from witnesses involved in near-death experiences, or others who have been present during the passing of those dearest to them. And if such accounts are to be believed, regardless of your own personal interpretation of heaven and hell, it is clear that these beings are utterly indifferent to our wishes and desires. Be they evil in nature, or mere servants to the instruction of a higher power, they will inevitably achieve their goal. Commonalities in the physical description of such beings across the ages make for troubling reading, adding credence to the arguments that they have always moved amongst us, claiming our loved ones. Features such as glowing red eyes, horns, and jet-black skin seem too recurring across the various cultures to be mere coincidence. And nowhere are such stories more prevalent than inside the corridors and side rooms of countless hospitals located around the globe, where so many people find themselves in a kind of limbo, when they are at their weakest and most vulnerable, sometimes receiving a visitor who is both unexpected and most definitely unwanted. In late 2019, a British man in his late 60s named Martin Kirk was admitted to a hospital in Staffordshire for heart surgery. Obviously, due to the nature of the operation, he was required to remain in hospital as an inpatient for several days after the procedure, so that the doctors could monitor his recovery. On the first night after the surgery had been completed, Martin awoke in his hospital bed, dazed, confused, and in quite a lot of pain. It took a few minutes to get his bearings and remember exactly where he was. Although it was dark, he had an overwhelming sense that someone else was with him in the small room, and for some reason, he did not feel safe or comfortable with that presence. So vivid was this feeling that he reached across with a heavy arm and fumbled with the switches next to his head, until he found the one that turned on the bedside lamps. In the dim light, he began to see movement in the shadows being cast against a nearby wall. At the very edge of these shadows, there was a strange shimmering, as if something was shifting around within them. The more Martin stared in bewilderment, the more intense this movement became, until something began to snake out from it onto the wall. Martin, still feeling the effects of his anesthesia, found it difficult to move, but seeing this strange phenomenon redoubled his efforts to find the emergency button. As he pressed it, the shadow immediately retreated, and a nurse arrived shortly afterwards. She was understanding that Martin believed what he had seen, and made a show of searching the area he had indicated. When she found nothing, she left him with some words of reassurance, stating that he had been heavily sedated and that this could sometimes cause hallucinations. Despite his overwhelming anxiety, the surgery had taken its toll, and he couldn't help falling back asleep. Later that evening, he was awoken by a faint tickling sensation on the calf of his right leg. Opening his eyes, he was horrified to see a jet-black hand snaking up from underneath the bed and touching his leg with its slender, clawed fingers. Screaming in terror, Martin kicked weakly at the appendage, which promptly retracted. With a great and painful effort, he managed to shuffle himself up into a sitting position and called the nurse in once again. She left after telling him that there was nothing under the bed, and that it was probably just a bad dream. but he was so haunted by this experience that he remained awake for the rest of the night, only allowing himself to sleep when daylight came. The following evening, terrified of what the darkness would bring, Martin tried to stay awake, but such was the trauma of surgery and the fogginess of pain-numbing medication that he inevitably fell asleep. When he awoke some time later, he found himself in complete darkness, but again, he felt that someone was nearby. Looking over towards the corner of the room, he saw what looked like a pair of red eyes staring at him. As his sight adjusted, he soon saw the outline of a figure standing there. He could not make out any features other than the bright red eyes, which remained focused upon him. Suddenly, he felt restricted. Looking down, he could see several pairs of deformed hands coming up from under the bed, grabbing at his limbs. He could feel their coldness through his bedsheets. He could feel his heart pounding in his chest, straining under the effort as he squirmed to free himself, until finally, he felt something like a sledgehammer blow to his chest, and then everything went black. When he awoke, it was the afternoon of the following day. One of the nurses informed him that his heart had stopped during the night, and that they almost lost him. For the rest of his stay, Martin continued to see dark shapes moving around inside his room, but they kept their distance and gradually ceased to visit him. He rarely slept at night, constantly terrified that they might return. As soon as he was well enough, he was discharged, and he never saw those shadows again. Martin had never been particularly religious prior to his experience, but has maintained since his stay in hospital that there is definitely a dark place to which the dead and dying are sometimes taken, and that he worries about what he will see when he takes his final breath on this earth. A similar story was related by an American woman named Jessica Martinez, who was admitted to hospital in the mid-2000s for a protracted period of essential medical treatment. Unlike Martin, Jessica was placed on a ward with several other patients, and as a result of her treatment, found it difficult to get any meaningful amount of sleep. As she lay in bed staring at her surroundings, Jessica had suddenly caught sight of an unexpected movement at the far end of the ward. With all the other patients apparently asleep and no medical staff in sight, she was curious as to what this movement might be, and peered through the darkness in an effort to identify it. At first, she saw nothing. Then, as she watched on, a slender shape suddenly unfurled itself from the shadows and slowly made its way across the room. Its outline was blurry, but she could see the definite contours of a head, arms, and legs as it wandered from one end of the ward to the other. It was a brief sighting, but she was disturbed by how slowly and deliberately it moved, and it was tall, at least 8 feet. Finally, it passed out of the doorway and down the corridor out of sight, leaving a stunned Jessica in a terrified silence. Nothing else took place that night, but over the coming days, she began to notice more of these shadowy figures moving around the hospital. She would observe them out of the corner of her eye, travelling along the hospital corridors and slipping into rooms through doors that were only open ajar. The doors never moved, they simply slid through the cracks. However, the most disturbing aspect of her visions was when she would observe them wander onto the ward and then bend down to whisper in people's ears. The other patients, doctors and nurses apparently couldn't see them, as they didn't react to their presence whatsoever. They never approached Jessica herself or gave any indication that they knew she could see them. One evening, she saw one of these entities bending over the patient opposite, apparently whispering in their ear, and within a few seconds, they had cried out and sat up in their bed, as if awaking from a terrible nightmare. The figure had then casually wandered out into the corridor. Jessica could only wonder what these beings were whispering to these people, but the thought chilled her to the bone. When she was well enough to leave hospital about a week later, she shared her experiences with her family, who told her that they were most likely just side effects from the pain relief she had been given in the aftermath of her surgery. But she disagreed, saying that apart from some sleep deprivation, she was in full control of her faculties. Another account involving such entities came from an anonymous nurse working palliative care at a hospice in Scotland. She wrote about her experience in an online nursing forum, and was shocked when other nurses also wrote that they had either heard similar stories from their colleagues, or experienced such things for themselves. The author described how an elderly patient had been admitted to her care, who was expected to pass away within the month. It was the nurse's job to ensure that the woman was as comfortable as possible during her final days, but she found that this particular lady spent very little time awake, and instead slept for lengthy periods of time. One morning the nurse was doing her rounds, when she heard a pained scream coming from room 2B, in which the new patient had been sleeping. She hurried over and opened the door to find the patient sitting upright in bed, mumbling about a dark shape which had tried to drag her away. The nurse calmed and reassured the patient as best she could, but even as she began to relax, she repeated over and over, "Don't let the darkness take me." She sat with the older woman for an hour or so before she fell back into a deep sleep. Little did she know that this would be the last time she saw the old woman alive. Several hours later, she had been sharing a coffee with another nurse when they were disturbed by the sound of a heart monitor flatlining and being broadcast to them at the nurse's station. It was coming from room 2B. Putting down her mug and hurrying across the corridor, she opened the door to see a dark shape next to the patient's bed. What looked like an arm was reaching down from what she assumed was its torso, with its hand disappearing into the older woman's chest, where her heart was situated. The nurse took a step back in shock, and then ran forwards out of concern for her patient, at which point the shape promptly dissipated. Attempts were made to resuscitate the old woman, but unfortunately to no avail. The nurse couldn't quite believe what she had seen as she had entered the room. In her post, she did entertain the idea that it was a momentary visual anomaly, but she couldn't shake the feeling that something else was afoot, given the fact that her patient had mentioned the dark shape prior to her passing. When she spoke to her colleagues about it, some of them confirmed that they had seen similar figures around the hospice, and in particular, next to the patient's beds, at or at least close to the time of their death. Others on the forum also shared this experience, especially those who worked in palliative care. Much like the assumption made by the family of Jessica Martinez, such experiences are almost universally put down to the effects of medication on the human brain. Patients undergoing lengthy and serious procedures, such as heart surgery, will often be exposed to large amounts of powerful drugs, like morphine, which can cause hallucinations and other emotional side effects. These visions can be caused by a hormone imbalance in the brain, even in milder painkillers, which do not list hallucinations as a possible side effect. The patient is already experiencing a large amount of stress and anxiety as a result of their admission to hospital. Their bodies have experienced trauma, and all these factors acting together could result in some sort of mental divergence. Those involved may find it difficult to process simple movements, such as an insect in flight or a curtain caught in a draft, and their minds may create phantom shapes or elements to justify the movement. This could go some way to explain why such visions are a regular occurrence within a hospital environment, But how do we explain instances where the staff, who are not on any form of medication, have also reported seeing these entities? Cultures such as the ancient Egyptians believed in the existence of demons, and theorized that these entities targeted specific areas and points within the body. They believed that there were key parts of the human nervous system designed to combat evil, similar to chakra points or energy intersections. When a person was close to death, it was believed these points became weaker and less functional, and it was at this time that a demon would attack and take control of the person's body, shutting it down and then taking their soul. As such, ancient Egyptian medicine centered around the various channels which circulated through the human body, and efforts were made to keep these channels and energy intersections free from interference, which would otherwise allow an entity to exploit such an obstruction and use it to cause death. With this in mind, it may come as no surprise that patients of heart surgery in particular report seeing these so-called demons more than any other, and subscribers to the concept of chakra points would argue that it's because the heart chakra, the body's main energy intersection, has been severely disrupted. It is perhaps interesting that religious belief seems to play little part in the existence of these proposed entities. Regardless of whether those involved accept the existence of a higher power, encounters with these so-called demons take place across the world, irrespective of the culture and faith of those involved.
Thank you to Bedtime Stories and Ballin Studios for visiting ours. Sasquatch Chronicles next hour. Stick around. Thanks for listening.
Listen to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, and we'll be right back after this message.
Owns you. If you're not in control, then someone else is. Join me, Ivy West, for Voices on the Wind, Saturday. I discuss government, health, metaphysics, suppressed science, universal mysteries, little-known incredible facts, alternative energies, and even more than you can imagine. Won't you join us on Revolution Radio Saturdays for Voices on the Wind with me, Ivy West?
There are lives in the balance, people on the fire, children at the cannons. There are...
Because if your head's in the sand, your tail is a target.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the Internet. Please help support this station so this battle can continue forward. Revolution Radio!
The Secret Kindergarten is here for the young children of the world. The best program on the radio for kids, dealing with the most important topics in the whole universe. Fairy tales, music and movement, numbers, plants, animals, fun, colors, insects. Take care and cast your ears out to catch a story from the world of other young things. Reach out. Up, under, and over. Sing a song. Talk about feelings. Just remember the magic word. The magic word is no. Step on into the Secret Kindergarten. Saturdays, 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Right here on Revolution Radio.
Join me and the Brian Ruse Show on Revolution Radio, Eastern Standard Time, every Tuesday night from 6 to 8. We talk about the four most vital things, in my view, affecting all of humanity. Number one is UFOs and aliens. in their agenda for the advancement of humanity. Number two is the Jewish establishment's control over all aspects of human civilization. Number three, the truth about Adolf Hitler, how he was the opposite of what we've been told. Number four is advanced ancient global civilizations. Join me on The Brian Roux Show, Tuesday nights from 6 to 8 on Studio B on Revolution Radio.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Any commercial advertising you may hear in this program is of the sole discretion and benefit of the host of this program you are listening to. Revolution Radio does not endorse any commercial products, nor does it accept monetary compensation for on-air advertising of commercial products, nor will it ever. We are and shall remain 100% listener supported. Any product advertising on this program are considered used at higher risk, and Revolution Radio shall not be held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps. The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
It looked like somebody was bent over and had their head in the window of the deer blind, and it either heard me or smelt me, and he pulled his head out of the tent and stood straight up, and that shocked me. They don't make people that big.
The way it moved, almost as if it was gliding across the beach. I've never seen anything move like that in my life. They were screaming at each other in gibberish. It sounded like a language, and they were chuntering away back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. I know what a bear looks like, and there is no way on this planet that what I saw were bears.
What are you reporting?
Jesus Christ, you better...
Sir?
Gia!
Hello?
Get somebody out here.
What's going on now, sir?
That son of a bitch is about 6'9", I don't know.
Do you see him now, sir?
Yes, I'm looking right at him. Uh-oh.
This is Tyler from Woodstock, Georgia, and you're listening to the best podcast on the planet, Sasquatch Chronicles.
For what's trending, a video of what looks like Bigfoot walking around Southern California, or Colorado rather. My bad. Take a look and see what you think.
A couple shared this video on social media saying they spotted Bigfoot while riding the Durango and Silverton narrow gauge railroad train. They told Out There Colorado most people on the train didn't notice anything. Over the years, there have been more than 100 reported Bigfoot sightings in Colorado.
Oh, wow. My goodness.
It totally blends in with the landscape there.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Do you believe in Bigfoot?
I really want to.
I do, too.
The logical side of my brain, though, is thinking that in the wintertime, though, in Colorado, if the color stays brown, then they're going to stick out.
Oh,
so
that makes sense.
Right?
Yeah. I want to, too, just because I feel like it's fun to believe in it, right?
Yeah.
Oh, I saw Bigfoot.
The unknown.
But you know what? I mean... To each their own.
Yeah, exactly.
My email has been flooded over this video. I don't know if you guys have seen this or not. As far as my opinion goes, if anyone cares. I put it up on the blog because I was getting so many emails about this video. I don't think that's a Sasquatch. They don't move like that. The behavior is off, you know, and it didn't take a lot of time to really look at it, but just watching it real quick once or twice, these creatures don't move like this thing moves. This thing's more like a man moving, and they don't hide the way this thing hides. You won't see, I've never heard of Sasquatch just sitting down on the rocks trying to blend in. If there's no major cover, a lot of times you'll see them just kind of walk off, kind of like what Patty did. Think about Patty. Patty's not going to sit down in the middle of the creek and like next to a rock. Just everything about it screamed it wasn't real. And I don't think that the people who filmed it were a part of it. I think there's something going on there with the train. They're trying to drum up business. I guess I should have said, welcome to the show. Welcome to the show, everyone. Thanks for being here tonight. We're going to be chatting with Brian. And Brian lives in Washington State. He's actually not far from where I'm at. And back in 2009, he had a very strange encounter, and he actually found evidence of the creature being out there. But Brian, being a hunter, you know, he kind of sat on the fence, didn't really buy into the whole Bigfoot thing. You know, didn't have one feeling one way or another. If you've had an encounter and you'd like to be on the show, shoot me an email. My email address is wes@sasquatchchronicles.com. And if you get a chance, check out sasquatchchronicles.com. You can become a member and get additional shows. Let's jump into it tonight. I want to welcome Brian to the show. Brian, thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Wes.
Yeah, and I can't wait to hear about this encounter. This happened to you back in 2009, and I know you're kind of up around the Castle Rock area, but the areas that this happened to you, for me anyway, I'm sure the rest of the audience, it's irrelevant, but I know exactly where these areas are at. If you would, take me back to 2009 and how all of this started.
But we went on a turkey hunting trip. We left from the Castle Rock area and we went up to Mount Adams out of the little town called Trout Lake. It's kind of on the, I guess would be the southwest side of Mount Adams. And we went up the night before opening day. I took a gentleman with me who had never been turkey hunting yet. It was kind of one of his things he'd want to do. And I worked with him and at the job. So we went up to a place I'd scouted a couple weeks prior to that. And I got there in the evening, got out of the truck. Blew a crow call. I heard a turkey gobble in the distance, so I knew the birds were still in the area. So we set up camp. I set up the bed in the back of my Toyota pickup truck. He had a little pup tent on the ground, a little fire going. And I was sleeping in the bed of my truck. And for some reason, I don't know what woke me up. I don't know if the truck ever shook or could never verify any of that. I just remember I woke up in my sleeping bag with an overwhelming amount of fear. I mean, more fear than any of my deployments put into me overseas. I have never been this scared in my life, where the hair on the back of my neck was standing up. And I just was frozen in my sleeping bag, looking at the side window of my Lear canopy on my truck, saying, if something touches that window, what are you going to do? And so I have a pistol that I take with me in the forest, and it's a 45. And I just basically cocked the hammer inside my sleeping bag and was pointing it, you know, at the window, telling myself, if something touches that window, I'm going to fire, because there's nobody out here but me and this other gentleman who's with me. And unfortunately said he's short enough that he wouldn't be able to look through that window of that camper, that truck. He's vertically challenged. So, you know, time goes on and I'm still terrified. I'm just waiting there, quiet, slaying and laying. I'm not hearing anything. I'm not seeing anything through the tinted plexiglass, plastic type window, whatever that is. And as time goes on, you know, the fear starts to subside and I was able to fall back asleep. When on the next morning, my alarm goes off on my phone and I get out of the truck and I'm getting my gear on and Wayne's getting out of the pup tent. And I was like, you ready to go? And he's like, yeah. And he goes, how'd you sleep last night? And I was like, all right. He goes, well, I heard you get out and walk around camp. And I was like, I didn't say anything. I just kept it quiet. Well, right where we were camped at, there's a clear cut that drops off where they had logged. And you're up here, so you've seen these before. It kind of goes downhill, heading towards the west. And they had reprotted that years ago, which was putting Christmas tree-sized plants, you know, replanting. And we're looking down this with our binoculars, trying to see if we see any birds moving around. The sun's coming up. And we heard this really loud snap right to our left, big twig breaking. So we both looked to our left, and all we saw was this large, huge, black with a little bit of gray hint to it, object moving away from us in a downhill towards a draw, going downhill. And I could clearly make out shoulders, back of the head, maybe 2 feet down its back. And the rest of it was covered by the Christmas trees that it was going through to go away from us. Now, I've heard elk, deer, bears, cougars, all that stuff in the forest, and they all make specific sounds when they're running or walking. You know, you can tell the difference between how big it is, how small it is, but you could actually hear the thuds when this thing was stepping. It wasn't running. It wasn't hopping. It was just like a fluid motion of movement. Just, you know, just kind of going along like it's on a conveyor belt, but you could hear the boomf, 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 boomf. So the buddy I was with was like, well, what was that? And I was like, I don't know. What is that? And, you know, we start playing that back and forth thing. And he literally said, well, maybe it was a bear that stood up and was just kind of sniffing the air. And I was like, okay, I'll go for that. But it moved too far to be a bear. So there was just no way I could think that was a bear. Not possible. So we watched it. It just got away from us. And that little bit of the encounter probably took 20 seconds, maybe 20 seconds. And all we had with us was a 12-gauge shotgun, two inflatable decoys for turkey hunting, and my pistol. So we didn't have, like any type of arsenal or what anything. Most people go to the woods, they have guns all over them and knives and all this stuff. But so anyway, we walked back to the camp. It was about maybe 15 feet from where we were standing at. And I said, well, let's go to the second spot. So we hiked to that spot. And now that spot's maybe a quarter of a mile as a crow flies from where we're standing at, if you were to go in a straight line. We zigzagged to get there. And on this spot, we had to walk up a logging road at a certain little bit of an angle, and it makes a sharp left 90-degree turn. When it makes that sharp left turn right there, there's where the road had cut into the embankment on the side of the hill, the side skirt. You know, you have probably like a 3 to 4 foot embankment you have to go up onto to get off the road. Well, we went straight up over that to where our blind was, which is about 5 feet from the edge of the road. And when our backs are against the tree and, you know, we're calling, we hear some turkeys gobble. It's been really quiet. And you hear them gobble. It's been really quiet. Hear them gobble. So we're just taking our time. It's all of a patience game when you're turkey hunting. And maybe 15 minutes into the hunt, I'm thinking about that. Everything just got eerily quiet. The birds stopped chirping. You could hear like little things rustling around in the leafages on the ground as far as insects go. And my buddy says, you know, he's sitting there and the sun's hitting on him and time's going on. And he's starting to doze a little bit. And then out of nowhere, it sounded like a cop car had got right behind us somehow on that road where it makes that sharp turn. So it's 4 or 5 feet from me, but it's, like I said, it's a 4 foot to 3 foot drop to the road. You would have thought a cop car had turned on its siren, just the very first part of the siren. No other octaves, no other change, just this loud, not super high pitched, but a mid pitched scream. And it was terrifying. Like I rolled forward out of the turkey blind, grabbed my .45 from the holster, and I stood up, and I saw the same thing again going down away from us through a draw, but this was very heavily vegetated, and it sounded like a herd of elk going down through those trees. It was just smashing through there. The gentleman that I was hunting with, he's a devout LDS, a Mormon, and he actually looked at me, and that was the first time I've ever heard him swear. He said the F word, and, you know, so what the F was that? I was like, I have no freaking clue. We grabbed the decoys, went to the Jeep, and we were gone. That was the instance of that part.
Yeah, and I want to ask you about that, because I know there was another incident that happened in September. I'm curious, though, that noise that you heard, you describe it kind of like a siren. And there's a famous howl from Ohio that kind of sounds like an air raid siren. I know you said police siren, but did it sound anything like this?
No, this was more like if you were to do the motion or the sound of a whoop like that, but just hold the whoop, that part right there. But it was just so loud, like you could feel it. And what freaked me out the most was is I don't know how this thing was able to get that close to me without me hearing it. You know, they said they smell. I didn't smell odor of any type. But that doesn't mean they don't. I mean, could have the wind blowing the opposite direction. But it just shocked me that this thing was able to get that close to both of us. You know, and then I had never heard anything like that in the forest. I've heard, you know, like I said, the elk bugle. I've heard the deer grunt and the turkeys gobble and the coyotes. I've heard all of that growing up here. In Washington State, but I've never heard that sound before. And interestingly enough, I was a mailman. That was my job when this was happening, and I delivered mail to the Washington State Fish and Game Office. So when I went in there, I spoke to one of the people there, and I didn't tell him the whole story. I just said, "Hey, what in the forest makes a sound like this?" And he's like, "Oh, it's a cougar." And I'm like, "There's no way that was a cougar. I've heard plenty of mountain lions and cougars. They don't sound nothing like that."
Yeah, I've heard that at the Browns property. I've only heard it one time, but that long woo, you know, it goes on and on forever. And it kind of sounds like a man when you first hear it. But the sound and the amplitude coming towards you, you know, it's not a man. The 20-second view you got of it going through the Christmas trees, what stood out to you the most? And was it on two legs the whole time?
It never went like vertical horizontal, like a bear would go from the two to the four leg standing motion. Never saw that take place. So the whole time it was a vertical movement of this animal was straight up and down, you know, like as a human. And I'll say walking because that's the only obvious thing that I could say that was, as it just, you know, went down along the draw through the trees. I didn't see arms moving the trees like out of the way. It just went right through them. Like they weren't there. It didn't look back at us. Cause I would have loved to seen like, you know, some type of facial detail of this thing, but it was all from the back. And, you know, I've heard people say, well, it doesn't have a neck. No, this does not have a neck. It looked like a silhouette that the military trains on when they shoot at the target range. It's a white back with a black, you know, like shoulder silhouette and a head. There's no neck on it. Well, this is what this looked like, only, you know, 5 feet across at the spread. And, those trees were easily, I'm 6'1", and they were as tall as me, if not taller. And where I saw it go through some of these places, it was taller than the trees. That's what perplexed me so much was, you know, we both look at this thing and we're like, what is that? And your brain, like I was talking to you earlier, it just doesn't register. You can't understand what you're looking at because your whole life you didn't think it was real. And then all of a sudden, here it is, and it's a limited amount of window. It's not like a long drawn out process with what happened with me anyway. It was just so fast, you know, so I couldn't have reacted to any of this stuff, even with all the training that I have, the hunter training, everything that I've, you know, done throughout my life. I could just speak for myself, but I couldn't react to that situation. Otherwise I would have, you know, when you know, that's what I tell people. You know, the people that I've talked to since my sightings happened throughout the years, you know, I've heard people comment about theirs or whatever. And I just look at them and I say, hey, if you've seen it, you know, you know, that's just, there's no other way around it. It changes your life. It changes everything about the forest and what you believe on some things. And yeah.
Yeah. It makes me wonder how close they were to you when you were in the tent. You know, and you handled that situation better than I would have. I know you're a Marine, and I probably would have shot, and I'm not proud to say that, but I always say, you know, you want to get shot, put a gun in someone's hand who's terrified, and you're probably going to get shot. And I want to come back and ask you a few questions about that. But going to this most recent incident, when you see this thing, and it's kind of going downhill away from you guys, but then you guys hear the vocalization, it's really close to you. Do you think there was more than one? Or do you think it was that same one that you guys saw that was vocalizing at you?
The direction it moved away from us, Wes, and then the direction that we took to the secondary blind location where we were hunting from that time, I would think it would have been the same one, because he would have went downhill, as did we, but we were, you know, say a quarter of a mile north of the last sighted location of that, basically, but we both went downhill. So it could have very well turned to the north and walked up the same way, you know, and didn't realize we were there, and maybe it heard me calling. I have no idea. It looked like the same one about size generations, so I can't say there was more than one. I've heard people say that they travel, you know, more than one at a time type situation, but that's the only one that I saw. And it may have shook the truck to wake me up, but for some reason I woke up from a sleep, like I said, mortified is the word. I guess that's a good word to use.
Yeah, and I always find that odd in encounters, and I can relate to exactly what you're saying. It's a very different type of fear. You know, you come across like a cougar or a black bear. Our cougars out here in Washington State are probably the biggest in the United States. I'm assuming. I've seen some big cougars, but there's always that fear when they're around. But the fear that you're describing is a very dark, it's very, I'm in mortal danger if I don't get out of here. Something's very wrong, but you hadn't seen anything at this point. It's very hard to explain that to people.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, Wes. There's no, like I said, it's when I've been deployed overseas, the two times that I went over there away from my family, my wife and my daughter and all that, and, you know, did my job and all that stuff. It's scary. It's, you know, you don't know what the heck's going on because you just don't have information. Nobody tells you enough information about anything in life is kind of how it goes. So when you run into one of these things, it's like all you've heard of is people's encounters. There's nobody said, hey, you should do this or do that. But, you know, you run into a hunter. Well, if a bear comes at you, you should run uphill or play dead or, you know, there's never been so you don't expect anything like this to ever happen. You know, you hear something or you see something or something happens and you're just blown away. And the level of fear that hits you is, yeah, it's just hard to describe to people. There'd be no way to, I don't know how you could even produce that type of fear on someone to show them what it would feel like.
Did you guys ever go back to that exact same spot?
We have not been back there. However, I just came back from an Eastern Oregon deer hunt, and I'm trying to talk my little brother into going there with me to go check it out again, just to see what it looks like, because I haven't been there since 2009. I'm sure everything's grown up, but the areas where I turkey hunted at had been like old growth burned areas, so there wouldn't be too much stuff there right now. It was pretty clear with some acorn trees, but I would love to go back there. I would love to, you know, get a better view of it face to face. Even though it's terrifying, I just want to make sure it's real, I guess. Yeah. Hopefully it won't do anything bad to anybody. Cause nobody really knows. Like I said, I heard stories, living here in Castle Rock, there's a lot of loggers and a lot of, hunters that have been around a while. I've heard stories of old man feeds them Fruit Loops. There's a family that comes down every once in a while from Mount St. Helens up by Merrill Lake. So I've heard from, you know, local legends, as I like to call them, the older guys. They tell me their stories and stuff when you're just talking to them. And it's,
yeah, a lot of stories come out of that area. And I know you're basically next door to where I'm at. But there's a lot of hunters go to these areas where you're going, like near Mount Adams. I mean, that place is notorious for sightings. And as you get up to Rainier and, you know, all these places are where we go to hunt. And there's a lot of encounters. I mean, you could probably stop 10 people in Castle Rock and ask them if they either know someone or if they've seen the creature themselves. And probably nine out of 10 people will say they have. And I think even Castle Rock, you know, recently Mark Marcel, he found the mine that Fred Beck and all those miners were using. And I didn't think he'd ever find the thing, but he actually found it. And that story from Ape Canyon up towards Mount St. Helens, I'm assuming everyone knows the story, but it's the Ape Canyon attack up there happened back in the 20s. If my memory's right, it wasn't Fred Beck, but I want to say it was either his brother or his brother-in-law came down to Castle Rock, got drunk in a bar, and was telling everyone what he just came from. What happened up there at the mountain. And I think a guy from the Columbia newspaper was in there. I think that's how the story actually got out, if my memory's right. So there's a lot going on in this area. Tell me about what happened in September.
All right. Well, so that was in April for turkey season. And in September, we were archery elk hunting up there in Democratic Lake. Now, this time we were about 2.5 miles from where we turkey hunt. So when you come into Trout Lake, there's a Chevron gas station and a double Y there at that road. And if you go straight, you're basically going towards the mountain and the snow camps and all that. Well, behind that gas station is a Trout Lake. Now it's an animal habitatory thing, I think is what they're calling it. So you can't actually hunt inside of it anymore. You can hunt the outsides of it, but we were hunting the inside of it when this took place because they hadn't changed the law yet. We're out there bow hunting. I'm walking with a buddy who's hunting with me. And the same guy who was in the tent, Wayne, was roughly 3 miles away from where we were, you know, that's just a ballpark figure. We carry those little Rhino GPS 650s. So it's like a GPS radio. When you key the handset, it updates your friend's locations on the radio. When we're hunting, so it's, if we have to find each other or we get lost, you know, it's easy to locate one another. It gives you a better advantage anyway. So we're up there hunting along Trout Lake Creek. I'm up on the hills with my other friend, and Wayne's down below us. And he calls me on the radio, and he's like, "You got to get over here and see this." And I was like, "See what?" He's like, "Oh, you really need to come over here. It's worth it. You really need to see this." And I was like, "Well, where are you at?" And I look at the radio, and I'm like, "You're like 2 miles away from us, Wayne. What do you know, what's going on?" And he's like, "Oh, you wouldn't believe me. You just got to come see it." So me and Vance are talking a little bit, and we're like, "Well, let's just go see what the heck's going on. We'll hunt that direction." So we hunted that direction. It took us a little while to get there. Then we had to cross the Trout Lake Creek, the actual river that comes down. So we crossed that to get to him. We come walking around this corner where this little oak tree shrub stuff is right on the bank. It's kind of sandy. And I walk up, I'm like, "What's going on?" And he's like, "Look down." And I looked down, and there was a footprint. First one I've ever seen. It was like away from touristic activity areas or, you know, a Bigfoot museum or whatever. Because there's a lot of stuff, like you said, up here in the local area. You'll go walk into a store and see a Bigfoot cast or something. But where we were at was in the bottom of this nasty draw. And nobody's going to walk down there barefooted. It's just not going to happen. In the size of it, it was bigger than ours, our feet. We didn't take pictures. We didn't carry cell phones back then. And our rhinos don't have a photographic ability, unfortunately. So we put our boots next to it for just size comparison. We're like, "Wow, this thing's freaking huge." You know? And so if I was to guess the size of it, I would say it was every bit of 14.5 to 15 inches in length, probably 5 to 6 inches in width. But you could clearly make out the footprint. In the sand, you could definitely tell it had been there, within recently a couple days, cause it was still pretty crisp in the sand, and sand gets wet. It just kind of goes away pretty quick. So we saw that one, and in front of it, there may have been of a heel part before it was stepping on the trees and all the down pine needles as it was going back up along the higher portion to go up the mountain. So that's what happened there on that morning. Now where we were hunting, we're overlooking that elk animal habitatory thing I was mentioning in the beginning of this part. And we're sitting on the ridge up there, and every once in a while you'd hear a whooping sound down out of that swamp area. But it was not really like you didn't think it came from something very big. It sounded like it came from something small, would be my guess. So we just started having these weird things happen there. You know, some of our other friends would be like, what was that noise? And we're like, we don't know. We've never heard that before. So we just started hearing noises that we can't explain because we'd never heard them before. You know, it's just one of those, well, we don't know.
It sounded like it came from something small.
That was all in the same year. It was all in 2009. It wasn't like a 2010 elk hunt and a 2009 turkey hunt. It was all in the same year.
Yeah, and I might have missed it earlier. You might have already said it, but how far away is where you were hearing these noises and finding the footprints as opposed to just a few months earlier you guys had seen the creature when you were turkey hunting? These two spots, how, you know, as a crow flies, how far away are they from each other?
As a straight line as the crow flies, I'm 2.5-3 miles at the most.
Yeah, I know the area from hunting. I know Trout Lake, and I mean, you guys are basically right there on top of where the last incident happened.
Yeah, so if you've been up the Trout, you've been to Trout Lake, I'm sure, where that chevron is. If you go straight, you know, like a, I don't know, half of a mile, that's where the road to the left goes to the animal sanctuary. That's what we'll call it. It's not a sanctuary, but it's easier to say it that way. Or you can go right out to what is known as like Hoosom and BZ Corner and all this. And so I go right to go turkey hunting because it's a little drier. And then I go left to go elk and deer hunting because it's more of a, you know, this typical Washington rainforest in that area. But the habitat's better for the elk over there than the drier part. It's kind of right on the border where the east-west line is.
Yeah, it's been many years since I've been up there. And, you know, even in the last couple months, I've had people who've had encounters up there. I had one guy run out of Trout Lake. He's from, if my memory is right, he was from Laurel, which is east of Trout Lake. So it'd be different than the way you and I would go in. But, I mean, there's a lot that goes on up there. I want to go back and ask you about this fear that you had that first night. You know, I think a lot of their behavior is meant to terrify you. It's meant to make you go away. And I'm not so sure they're looking for a fight, but they will act like it to make you leave. But, you know, in this situation, you hadn't heard anything yet. I know the guy you were with, he said he thought you were out walking around the campsite. But you're sitting there and you have this overwhelming sense of fear and dread, like your life is in serious danger. And to me, that just seems very unnatural. That seems very not normal. What's your take on that?
It would be hard to explain. As far as like a Bigfoot going or Sasquatch, you know, all the different names for it. I just think it's a Neanderthal. I could be wrong, but mankind could have came from that. That could have been us, you know, 1,000 years ago. That could have been what we looked like. No, there's no one to really say that isn't. But I would definitely say that it was curious from what, you know, how I explained to you what happened and the reactions I was getting from it was, yeah, it was curious. It came there in the dark, checking out what we were doing. It watched us get out of the truck. It didn't expect us to come to right where we did. And then it was maybe like, oh crap, there they are. I need to move. And then when it moved, it made the noise. And then, you know, it realized we saw it type situation. And then it accidentally, inadvertently just happened to walk by where we actually ended up going to maybe. So it came in to see what that was. Maybe it realized, hey, that's not a turkey. That sounds kind of weird, but you know, I'm not exactly sure, what brought it to that location. But I would definitely say it was curious. Because of the size of it, like you said, Wes, if it wanted to hurt us, it would have done it. There would be nothing that would have stopped it. I had a pistol and a shotgun with us. That was it. I honestly think those would have just made it mad.
Just leave. They'll leave you alone. I know you've been a hunter your whole life, but prior to this happening to you, what was your feelings about Sasquatch?
I was never a non-believer, but I wasn't a believer. I was on the fence. I was always like, well, if I see something, then I'll believe in it. Because growing up, I'd meet guys all the time. You know, I saw a Bigfoot or a Sasquatch. And I'd seen, you know, In Search of It, Leonard Nimoy. I've seen the Bigfoot stuff. And then, you know, there are towns around here in Washington State where they have Bigfoot parties and protect the hairy beast. It's illegal to shoot at them. And so throughout the years, I'd heard of it. But I'd never actually seen one or, you know. growing up, I'd hear noises in the forest, but I didn't put two and two together thinking, oh, well, that was a wood knock, or that was a whoop, or that was a rock hitting the water. Because you would hear things and be like, oh, a ground sliding or a rock slide. You would never put that kind of stuff together or think about any of it. Or you're driving down a logging road, and out of the corner of your eye, you catch what appears to be a silhouette of a person, you know, and then you stop your car and you back up and it's gone. And you're like, well, I know there was something that was just there, but then it's not there anymore. So yeah, my whole thing with them before was if I run into it and see it, then I'll definitely, you know, stand on the side of the guys that have, because there's no other way around that. Once you see it, you see it. And I think in order to see it is you have to put in the time. It's not a, you're lucky you go out on, you know, I'm going to go camping on Friday and you see it on Saturday. You know, I really think if the people that see it spend a lot of time in the woods, they're hunters, they're hikers, they're people at photography. And there are the occasional, whoops, there it is, you know, crossing the road thing. I hear a lot of those, but like my sighting, it took years. I'm 50 years old. I've seen two bears in the wild, in the woods hunting. One cougar, actually, you know, that face-to-face type situation now. But I've seen them through the binoculars and all that at a distance. Not as much. But so I'm just saying is it's when it comes to these, nobody knows the numbers of them or anything really about them. So I'm just saying, you know, there could be one every 20 square miles or whatever type situation. There's apparently a couple of grizzlies in Washington, but nobody sees them. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I understand where you were coming from. I mean, most hunters, especially in Washington State, because we hear about Sasquatch so much, I think most hunters are kind of on the fence until they see something or maybe hear something that throws them off, you know, because they're out there all the time. And to your point with cougars, I mean, you're right. Here in Washington State, you think we'd be tripping over them, but you'll rarely ever see one. You know, I like to ask everyone on the show, what do they think Sasquatch is? And you kind of alluded to it earlier with it being a Neanderthal. I'm curious, and not that it's a wrong answer, because like I said, no one knows, but what makes you think Neanderthal?
To me, it just after seeing it and then, you know, actually seeing a print on the ground with your own eyes, not something on television or secondhand knowledge, it's like you're looking at it. You know, and after you see how this thing moves and the sounds of the sticks breaking, and, you know, you're like, man, that sounds just like a real heavy person taking steps, because we could hear the thump, thump, thump. It wasn't like a loud thump, thump, but you could tell. There was something about it that you, oh, wow, I can hear it walking. Something about that made you do that. So that's why I'm saying, to me, it's, you know, half man, half ape. It's a Neanderthal. That's a bad boy caveman. That's made it, like our alligators and stuff, or these things. Oh, the prehistoric times. Well, maybe this is what this is. The way its shoulders look, the back of its head, from what I can see with my own eyes, it's so human/ape, you know, has the hair of the ape, but the body of a yoked out human, you know, I mean, like muscle bound, just big, big, big person. So that's what I'm going with. I've never seen anything to give me any different thought of that.
Yeah, I think that's a fair answer for sure. And, you know, a lot of their behavior, and I've said this many times on the show, a lot of their behavior is very animalistic. But having said that, a lot of their behavior is very human-like. Sometimes when witnesses will describe what the creature was doing, or, you know, there's times where I'll sit back and go, God, that sounds like something a human would do. And, you know, one time I was, many years ago, I had all these different Bigfoot casts sprawled out across my desk. You can buy, you know, these were all famous casts, and I think I gave away most of them to kids at conferences. But when I was sitting at my desk and I was looking at all of the footprints, I remember thinking, like, this looks like human feet, just on a larger scale. I mean, there's really nothing non-human primate about their feet, which is weird. I just find it very strange that we can't catch up with them. You know, and you know this from being a hunter, Brian. I mean, if you gave me the option of, hey, go find this cougar, it's in this general location, it might take me a while. If you tell me, hey, there's a human and he's kind of in this general area, I'll find the human all day long. And what's weird is these things are more like cougars. I mean, it's hard. It's like chasing a ghost at times, and it's frustrating that we can't catch up with them.
But see, I kind of look at it as in the perspective of how people always look, well, how come you haven't found a dead body, or how come there's not clear evidence of all this? And I tell them the same thing. I said, look, man, after 50 years of hunting in the forest pretty much every year that I could when I wasn't on active duty military, I never found a dead bear. I never found a dead cougar. I found plenty of dead deer, elk, coyotes. But those hardcore predators, I would never find their skeletons, their bones, their hides, just tracks and scat. That's all you would ever find unless you actually saw them or heard them. So when I look at it as in that, I'm like, well, maybe – you know, the Bigfoot's like the bear, and they eat their own or they bury them, you know, because I've heard from hunters that that's what they do. I have never physically seen that happen, but that's just what I've been told over the years. But I've only, like I said, I've only ran into two bears on foot in front of me on the ground where it's like, okay, this thing can get me right now. And that's in 50 years of, you know, hunting over the years. So yeah, I think they made it past the extinction, if that's what they'd wanted to call it, when everything was dying off. But they do look very human-like from the back, from what I saw in the footprint. That definitely had me on that one.
Yeah, you know, when people ask, especially skeptics, they'll ask me, you know, why don't we have a dead body? Why don't we have better pictures on game cams? And to me, those are very fair questions, and I don't have a great answer. Those are great questions. I don't have a great answer. And to your point, you know, all the years I've been hunting, you're right, I've never come across a predator that just died and was out there. You know, even prey, I would say most of the prey that I found that was dead, it was usually poached. But, you know, being in the rainforest, our forests eat that stuff up. Not much is going to last out there. So that whole argument actually makes sense when you're talking about the Pacific Northwest. It's an argument that's hard to argue with. I mean, but then you run into other problems. You know, what about down south? What about on these military bases? What about Nevada, Arizona? Even when I was down with the Border Patrol, you know, down there, those guys would run into Sasquatch. And they're pretty open about it. You know, you're talking the California-Mexican border. They're pretty open about the fact that they've run into them. And when I was down there, my first thought was, there's nowhere to go. There's nowhere to hide. There's no trees. It's all rolling hills. But yet they're running into Sasquatch. It's like some of the stuff is just hard to make sense of. You know what I mean?
I wouldn't know about that one either, Wes, because me being stationed down there, and I've been along the border several times. I could not see that being habitat for them, but I could be wrong. Like you said, there's nowhere for them to hide down there. It's just sagebrush. There's nothing really to hide. They only have those canyons. They have canyons and, you know, wadis and washouts and stuff like that, but it's not forested up here like Washington. You know, it's a national range forest. It's very dark. You go off the logging roads up in this place and you'll get lost if you don't know where you're going in certain areas that haven't been logged or sprayed for vegetation. I just think they're a ninja at the forest. You know, they grew up out there. They've lived out there. If you could snap your finger and throw one in downtown in a city, it wouldn't know what to do with itself. It would, you know, it would be a culture shock, just like it is kind of us for us going out there. But at the end of the day, what I lays the most proof to me that these things are 100% real is we have on this planet multiple tribes for hundreds of years that have drawn these things on totem poles, drew them on the walls, talked about them in their legends, made them as mythical beasts or gods or whatever. And we have to think as the Native Americans here in Washington, the tribes here in Washington, like the Kalish tribes and some of the other ones, they were very simple. They weren't – it's like the kids today, we have weird imaginations of space travel and all this stuff. They didn't know what spaceships were back then. They didn't have anything to put that in their brain. So from the people that I have talked to that study this stuff is like they were literally drawing what they saw. Their statues were made of replications of what they saw, of things that somebody had seen, because it's like, look at what they had to look at all the time versus like what a person today has to look at. You know, so our minds are, we see different colors, different objects, different things, versus what they saw. So you're talking about simple life. They throw it on a totem pole or on a wall on a painting. Well, if you look at it as the way that these gentlemen that I was talking to, then they would be right because they were drawing what they saw. There's tribes in Russia that say it exists. There's some in Southeast Asia, Vietnam. Now you have the United States and then you have Canada. So if all these different tribes all around this planet were saying these things were there, then I'm like, okay, they were here because they're the ones that tell us about a lot of things that we base things off today. You'll hear them bring it up. Well, the Mayans or the Incans or the, you know, that's the way they did it. Or so I just, once I started thinking about it after my sighting, I decided to delve into a little bit of it here and there because I wanted to really know what it was. I really wanted to know what I was looking at. And that's why I can say I would love to have it happen again under a controlled circumstance. So obviously I don't intentionally want to harm one. I've never wanted to do that, but I want them. I've heard people say, well, we need to get one to protect it. And I agree there. If it went in, it's proven 100% when the government says, yeah, they're real, you know, which eventually I think they will, cause they're doing it with the aliens right now. Right. I would just think that the reason why they're not telling us right now is how many hunters would want to go out in the woods and mount one of these things on their wall, you know? Because that's a lot of hunters are trophy hunters. They're not, they don't do it to fulfill a pastime or some, you know, I like to hunt. I mean, you know, it's a male thing. I want to provide for my family, whatever. That's what I was born and bred to do. Some of these guys just want to go out and kill stuff and throw it on their wall and be like, oh, look what I got. So I've always told myself, well, if they, you know, if the government were to come out and say, okay, Bigfoot's real, you can't shoot it anymore, how many of these hunters, these multi-million dollar hunters, are going to pay millions of dollars to put one on their wall?
No, you make it a felony and that problem goes away.
I would 100% agree with you, but, you know, using a weapon in a crime is a felony, but it doesn't stop people from doing it. You know what I mean?
It's a good point, man. It's a really good point. And, you know, with the whole alien thing, there's something coming down the road and they have to prepare people, but you can't just come out and show all your hand. You have to slowly spoon feed the mob, you know, as far as what's going on, so that people, by the time you get to showing everything, no one cares because you've kind of prepped the valve, so to speak, as far as information coming down the pipeline. And I don't believe for 2 seconds the government is covering it up because, you know, they're worried about people shooting them or they're worried about us wiping out another species, or I just don't buy it. I don't buy any of that stuff. The only time the government gets involved, the United States government anyway, and after I say this, I'll be waiting for my IRS tax audit. the only time the government really cares about subjects like this, like with the UFO thing, is if they can take advantage of it, somehow weaponize it, somehow use it to their advantage. Otherwise, I don't think they really care one way or another. And that's what makes me really wonder about Sasquatch.
No, I would agree with you on that, looking at it from that side, 100%. But that was, you know, I just wondered, and that was kind of the only logical thing I would come up with, was to keep people from, you know, overflowing into the forest. And maybe there's stuff out there that they're really not wanting people to find that, you know, so they keep us kind of in a closed environment. You know, don't go out, don't go too far. You might find something. So we want to keep you like on a leash, keep you, you know, where people are only going so many miles away from society, basically.
Yeah, it's a mystery for sure. And I think most people don't need the government to come out and tell them what's true and what's not, especially over the last couple of years. What's that old saying? Believe half of what you see and none of what you hear. I feel like that a lot of the times when the government comes on, you know, anyone from the government tells you anything, and not aliens, I'm just saying anything in general. It's kind of like, I don't know, you smell a lot of BS coming from these talking heads. And it would be nice, though, I mean, for the people who are on the fence or maybe don't believe, for them to come out and say they're real and, you know, maybe say, hey, if you're in this situation, do this. You brought up the black bear. And black bear, you know, there's – I don't know that there's much you can do. Running uphill, they're going to outrun you. I think that's a tale that hunters say, you know, run uphill. They have troubles running uphill. I don't know, man. I've seen a lot of black bears on videos, and they have no trouble running uphill. And you can't play dead. I guess with a grizzly you can, but not a black bear. I mean, you're not going to outrun it. You're not going to outclimb it, and you're not going to outswim it. But I think when it comes to Sasquatch, I think it's like I tell people, and I was telling you earlier, I really believe if you're in a situation and you turn around and leave, 99% of the time, I think they're going to leave you alone. And that's my opinion, of course.
And I do too, Wes, because like I said, it had me in the truck. I was in a box. There was no way for me to get away from it. So if it came there with the intent to hurt a human, I was easy. It would have been like putting a mouse in a paper bag and stepping on it.
I don't know, man. You got a Marine with a .45 on the other end. You know what I mean?
Well, if it would have touched the window, I would be showing you pictures or something. You know, there wouldn't be a phone call report, but I was able to I hope I don't ever feel that
wait,
fear
what,
again.
Wait, I'm lost.
That way. That level
wait,
of
hang on
is,
a second. He
it's
said,
unbelievable
wait, this
what
guy,
it does, how it makes you.
Pause. This guy said that if he would have touched the window, he'd be seeing pictures. Pictures of what? I thought he said that they didn't bring any cameras back in 2009. That's why they couldn't get a photo of the footprint. This guy seems to have contradicted himself. I've got a 45. We weren't safe. Wes says, well, you know, if you would have, you know, you got a Marine with a 45. The guest said, well, if you would have touched the window, you would have seen pictures of what? A dead Bigfoot? That doesn't make any sense. I thought you said earlier you didn't have cell phones. You didn't have camera. You didn't have a way to take a photo of the footprint or the Bigfoot you saw. Once again, folks, I'm calling B as in B, S as in S, simply because this guest is contradicting himself. Brian is contradicting himself. Once again, once you contradict yourself in a Bigfoot story, and I call it out, you then fall into the B as in B, S as in S category. And I'm going to ask it again. Why don't any of these sons of bitches, and I apologize for the children listening, why don't any of these sons of bitches have any photographic evidence whatsoever? Oh, I forget. Because as I wrote in the room, as Wes says, and I quote, I don't have a great answer. And then I added, but I know Bigfoot is real. So when skeptics come up to Wes and say, why don't we have this? Why don't we have this? Why don't we have that? Wes admits, well, I don't have a great answer. But he aligns with, well, you know, Bigfoot is real because we know Bigfoot does this. And we know if you encounter Bigfoot and simply walk away, he's not going to bother you. Well, how do you know that? Oh, because Johnny and Janie, who happen to see Bigfoot while they're tramping through the woods with, I don't know, weaponry of something and claim they've encountered Bigfoot, then say to themselves, well, I just walked away. Yeah, you know, that's right. People I talk to have seen Bigfoot say, if you don't challenge Bigfoot, he's just going to leave you alone. And my thought is, a shotgun, like I wrote in the chat room, can take out a kneecap. Why would you not do that? Bigfoot can't run with a kneecap blown out. No bipedal can successfully navigate terrain after being shot in the knee and losing a kneecap. I'm just saying, damage to the quad. Depending on how you hit them, perhaps from the back, hamstring, calf, various ligaments, etc., etc. I don't know. This guy just seems to be full of B as in B, S as in yes. As always, the link in the chat room, if you'd like to listen to the last few minutes of episode 996, the overwhelming fear that Brian apparently felt from the Sasquatch. and everything's a proper noun, the Sasquatch. I mean, I got no idea. That had to have been recording, because I think I said last week that I was going to stop using the one PC for the show, and I was going to switch to the other, to the laptop. I think I'm doing that next week, because I tell you, everything is sensitive. I click on the minimize and the windows close. Skype just hangs out there in no man's land for a while before it pops up. It's a mess. We got the lizard people taking over the world. Dogs and cats living in harmony. It's Armageddon. It's the rapture. It's a zombie apocalypse. It's a UFO invasion all in one. That about wraps up the award-winning but yet to be nominated This, That, and the Other Heard every Monday and Thursday here in Revolution Radio, located at revolution.radio, common spelling in your favorite internet browser. Please, as always, head over to the website. We are 100% listener supported. You can become a patron through Patreon. There is the donor box. You can click on the schedule. Look at open time slots, Studio A, Studio B. Click on the contact tab once you find a time block you are interested in, and host your own show. It's easy peasy, lemon squeezy. As always, thank you for listening. Have a fabulous Monday evening or Tuesday, depending on where you are. We'll talk with you on Thursday. As always, in the words of Katie Couric, good night, y'all.
Revolution Radio every Wednesday 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here, Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.